Monday night up at Cave Hill to listen to literary readings. It's a first, and we're thrilled, and I'm really grateful to all of you who made the effort to come up here and be with us tonight. I'm just going to give a very brief introduction. You have the program. We're going to stick to time because the main thing here is to listen to our writers and to take questions from the audience and generate some kind of discussion. So I'm just reading a little bit from the flyer, which I hope you all saw in the press over the last couple of weeks. We've been trying to advertise this event. And the evening's event is called Breaking Sexual Silences, Readings and Discussion, Living and Loving in Different Ways in Our Caribbean. And I start off with kind of controversial-ish lyrics from, I think it's Sizzler, but all you young people would know better. Rastaman, now apologize to no batty boy. Do dancehall lyrics like this speak for the majority of us, and I mean us in this room, us in the Caribbean? Are we the most homophobic society in the world? Does our popular culture endorse hate crimes against gays and lesbians? Well, that's what the international media are saying about us. What we want to do tonight is to listen to some other Caribbean voices, those of the artists, not the musicians this time, not the dance hall, but the writers. And I want to welcome most particularly our award-winning writers and scholars in their own right. Thomas Glave, who's going to launch his book, A Gathering of Lesbian and Gay Writing from the Antilles. He'll be available to you to have your book signed when you buy them later, which I'm sure you will. And Unya Kempadu, author of Buxton Spice and Tide Running, who will also be available to sign copies of her books, which are available on that table there. Okay, I want to just say that this event is part of a partnership project, Breaking Sexual Silences, which is a kind of a collaborative effort between Reading University and the Department of Language, Linguistics and Literature, UWI Cave Hill. It's sponsored, and we're very grateful for, a British Academy ACU grant for international collaboration. And what the project aims to do is to bring together writers, scholars, activists, and now you, the public, to discuss the way that literature can offer a different and more positive perspective on sexual desire and freedom in the Caribbean. Now, when Thomas launched his book, last month in St. Augustine?
Yes.
Or Caribbean. When Thomas launched the same book in St. Augustine fairly recently, the very trendy St. Augustine campus actually publicized the event on Facebook, and there was a lot of responses. And some of them read thus: UWI supports homosexuality. This is horrible. And then the response came quite soon afterwards: why is it horrible? And then, what would the UWI student prefer? Mind-blowing public lecture on summer parties and the quota of free drinks parties to non-free drinks parties? And humanity is diverse and should be equal. Well, we're here tonight to break some silences about sexuality, about terms like batty boy, about Caribbean women's sexuality. And I think these are important because, as Thomas says in introducing his Our Caribbean, this signals a critical new space for the directions and considerations and interpretations of Caribbean literature and gender discourses. And it's important to be launching the book and to be having this discussion here at Cave Hill because, as he says, it seems clear to me that in the 21st century, UWI should finally be in the vanguard of such directions and the discussions that they'll generate and indeed are generating, especially among younger scholars and writers who are poised on or centered in the exciting cutting-edge intersections that in recent years have emerged between queer theory and Caribbean literature. And so for tonight, let's leave out the brawling lyrics of the dance hall and let's feature the less noisy work, as Denise de Caries Narayan puts it, of Caribbean writers. They're going to discuss the way in which literary works can give us some other voices, can give us some other perspectives, can address issues of sexual desire and sexual freedom in ways that can help us to build a positive language, help us to structure tolerance for those who live and love in different ways. So welcome, everybody, and I'm now going to invite the head of department, Professor Jane Bryce, who's also helping to sponsor this event, to introduce our wonderful writers tonight. Thank you very much.
Good night, everybody. Good night, everyone. Just speaking for one moment as the head of the Department of LLL, I'd just like to say that this is, of course, the right place for Dr. Alison Donnell to have brought her project, Breaking Sexual Silences. Way back in 2006, Thomas Glave was here. He gave a seminar to the Cave Hill Theory in the Cave Hill Theory Project series called Queering Caribbean Literature, and a public reading of his non-fictional collection Words to Our Now, Imagination and Dissent. I don't know if you remember, Thomas, we all sat round in a circle here because so few people came, compared with tonight. But it was a wonderful discussion. And he also gave a creative writing masterclass, which I attended, in which he told us we had to, as an on-the-spot exercise, we had to write from the point of view of someone who was both male and female, but not hermaphrodite. And it was a challenge, I tell you. But I succeeded in writing something. The writers have requested separate introductions. So I'm going to first of all introduce Unya Kempadu, and then she'll read, and then I'm going to introduce Thomas. However, before I get into the separate introductions, just to say that both these writers are friends of this department. Both have contributed to its creative writing program by readings, writing masterclasses, and interacting with students. And both, very importantly, are activists working on a wide range of fronts to improve the conditions of life in the Caribbean. For example, for sex workers, people with HIV/AIDS, and LGBT people. And incidentally, for H people as well, because we benefit from improvements to the society. Unya Kempadu sees herself as a creative practitioner with an interest in human and personal development. And I want to emphasize her activist activities. She has wide experience as a consultant researcher and volunteer with international organizations and NGOs, private sector and youth organizations. And some of these are UNAIDS. She's been a consultant for the United Nations for their project Restoring Livelihoods in Grenada after Hurricanes Ivan and Emily. She's been a research assistant on the York University project Conceptualizing Incest in the Caribbean. And she's been a consultant for UNICEF Trinidad on a project about sport for development. So she's got very wide experience of community work at different levels. Her novels, Buxton Spice and Tide Running, draw on this experience to take us beneath the skin of Caribbean society. She's also completed a screenplay of her second novel, Tide Running, which is now available for production as a film. And she's working on her third novel, All Decent Animals, working title, set in Port of Spain. And she has another work in progress based on her community work in Grenada, which documents and voices an 18-year-old Grenadian girl's life story of sexual abuse, violence, and rape, but also love, sexuality, and motherhood. Also, the Department of LLL is currently discussing with Unya the possibility of her doing a residency in the department, possibly shared with the NCF, for a year in which she would put her skills to work across the various disciplines in the university. So using writing classes to explore the socio-cultural issues which arise from the kind of community activism that she's been doing. And tonight she's going to read to us from her first novel, Buxton Spice. Thanks, Unya.
Thank you very much, Jane, and good night, and thank you, everyone, for coming. Particular thanks to Evelyn and Alison for putting this all together and for this afternoon session on beginning this discussion. And I mean, it's a lot of discussion and fuss, but and I don't know, I mean, if we would just be honest in writing, talking, and sharing what is going on with us and around us, this place would be full of a lot of noise, I think. We wouldn't have these silences to break. But when we start shutting up and conforming and following rules blindly, we're just adding cement, the plaster to the walls that keep us silent. The blocks are being stacked all the time, and we could help to cement them together, or we could speak out, write, teach, paint, communicate to dismantle them. Just so that we're not locking up ourselves to live in a concrete sanitized cell. I started writing as a project, and the only thing I was really clear on was that I didn't want to romanticize or sanitize. I wanted to reflect a contemporary Caribbean life, characters, issues, and ways of dealing with them as I see, experience, and witness them. And then sex comes up. And then I'm known for writing rude things now and being bold. And then people look at me and they say, but you don't look like you're writing, you know? And you have all of these sort of stereotypes and things that we're supposed to conform to starts coming up. But you can stay away from them and continue writing, or you can interface with them. I'm just beginning to do that now. Once you begin to be honest and engage in discussion, though, you'll be surprised about the amount of things that go on, not just to do with sex and sexuality, but all sorts of doors open up. I will read from Buxton Spice, since it deals with emerging sexuality and what is very common among adolescent role play, etc., but put down on paper, it becomes uncomfortable for some to deal with and actually create silences around it rather than open up discussion sometimes. My second novel, Tide Running, also deals with exploring desire and touches on sexuality, but in adapting it for film, the whole question of anything that might be touching on homosexuality becomes a big deal. Have we seen a black man exploring possible bisexuality on screen in a feature film? Do we want to? Who is touching who becomes key in Ménage à Trois. Roles, stereotypes, these things become a big issue when you put it down on paper and you present it in any art form, really. Recently, a Bajan man told me that a man who is a woman's good friend, who is good for cuddles and you can talk to and is considered safe and so on, is called a Ken doll, because the doll is neutral. The Ken, you know the Barbie and Ken doll? Right, the doll is neutral. He just has a bump down there. He has no parts, but all the girls like him. So let's look at what little girls do with these dolls and stereotypes for a minute. Sammy and Rachel always fought over the remains of Barbie and Midge, the big sister's hand-me-down dolls. They both wanted Big Bobby Barbie, though she only had one leg. The loser would have mash-up Midge with her flat chest and only one arm. That left Ken, the man doll with no arms and a stupid expression on his face. And Cindy, one we made with another doll's head and arms, was a good white girl's name, we thought. Big Bobby Barbie was always so sexy, pushing up her bust all over the place and wobbling around tiptoe on her one foot. But her leg could swivel right up good. Mash-up Midge could do it too, and they'd skin up their flat, hard bunges anywhere. Sometimes you just open the cupboard and find the two of them there, just skin up, with all their clothes up over their head. We'd drag them through the garden, carry on up the Khyber, Big Bobby Barbie squeaking, Ken silent and smiling, sweating, climbing up the broad banana leaves, sticking in the mud. Sometimes for ski slope adventure, we'd visit the freezer, keep the door open for as long as we could, and rub their skin up bottoms on the ice. Barbie bawling, thrilling! Dash back downstairs, and Judy or me would take Ken and rub her hard on him. Ooh, not so hard, bang, 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 the hard plastic knocking together. Barbie's hard Bobby's beating his chest. Clack, 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 hold them together in midair and spin them against each other. Ooh, Ken, you're so wild. Midge would take it good from him too, and not be talking so much strippiness. And even Cindy got it, but her legs couldn't swivel up so. Ken would be smiling his stupid smile all the way through like he just made to grind. Dad's brought home a new brown-skinned Asian doll, Tamika. She was hot. She came with red panties and a sarong and black long hair, stout and smiling with flashy dimples. She showed Big Bobby Barbie and them what dark-skinned dolls can do. She had no top and a flat chest. But anytime she catch Ken, she give it him good. So vulgar, Barbie squawked. Cause she more sexy than you. No, no, she's just like those natives. And movie style, Rachel would pelt down Barbie flat on her face to howl and kick her one leg up and down. Today, Rachel is wife and I am husband. Sammy is wife and Judy husband. Sometimes we all just girls with towels over our heads for long hippie hair. We'd put on my sister's old bell bottoms, our shirts unbuttoned and tied in front, and practice pouting, slouching around, and swinging our hips about. Or sit sprawled out, legs wide open, pretending to smoke. A toss of the towel hair, chin in the air, and throat curved back in that bored, sexy way. The battery felt cold on my bunge inside my panty. Judy had a battery too. It gave me a very private feeling inside the huge, musty clothes. I'd found a blue shirt jack and a threadbare pair of my father's bay corduroy pants. Tied them up at the sides with string. The wives had on old bras stuffed with socks and pinned at the back, long dresses and pink and blue towel hair. Judy and I donned our shoes. They helped to give an important feeling and sauntered out of the house to the busy city streets. Street was the upstairs front room. We stood there chatting with our chins tucked in and hands in pockets, as men do when they're talking about important things. The fact that neither of our fathers went out to work on streets with pavements or stood and chatted in this sophisticated way didn't matter as we braced against the windowsills, casually crossing a leg. In the world of movies, which is how real people live, this is what men knew. Meanwhile, inside, Rachel and Sammy was doing what wives do. When I was a wife, I took pride in my housework. I didn't pretend. I got down on my knees and buffed the whole floor of the house room. I put away the kitchen neatly, made the beds without a crease, always aware of my towel hair swinging and the socks inside the brass pressing on my flat nipples. Them women in the Gary Cooper films was boring. They didn't even do anything. And then all of a sudden, their house would be spotless and dinner ready to serve. And when it came to getting down to business, they didn't even do that neither. As we stepped through the door from the hectic world of Wall Street, Sammy and Rachel hurriedly straightened their hair and dresses. We had timed our working day well, having been wives ourselves and knowing how long it took to clean the room. We pecked them gravely on the cheek, pretending to take off hats and hang them behind the door. In a wary, resigned way, we mumbled about it being another day, and we all sat down to eat. Seating on the floor, around the square piece of block cloth that the girls had carefully laid with books, we picked up our pens and pencils and began to eat politely without further talk. The wives kept glancing at our expressions to see how good their cooking was. Wasn't bad, loaded with things we'd never eaten or seen. This broccoli is lovely. Where the pork? Judy snapped. We all instinctively looked to the center of the cloth for a second and then bust out laughing. This is a vegetarian meal, Sammy said. Well, how come we eat in lamb? Judy asked. It was delicious anyway. But with so much manners, the wives took forever to finish eating. They was chewing with their front teeth, mouth closed up, lips mincing like when somebody with no back teeth trying to chew one grain of rice at a time. The dishes were cleared away and washed on the top of the chest of drawers, while Judy and I went about pinning up sheets over the windows. And then it was night. Taking off everything but my panty and battery, I slipped under the sheet and watched the wives undressing. They took off everything, even bras and panties. As Rachel took off hers, the lump of socks stuck to her flat chest. I thought she had the most beautiful body of all of us. She knew it too. Knew that it was the closest thing to the movie kinds. Me and Sammy, we were all arms and legs, and Judy was athletic with a long body and hard, powerful legs. But Rachel had a soft, well-proportioned body and small feet without a crease on them. I held the sheet up high as she climbed in. We all said goodnight to each other and plopped and turned about in the bed, making settling down noises. I puffed the pillow again and slapped my head down on it. Rachel's back was towards me, and the room was orange and warm. I stuck my head under the sheet and stared at the lovely swirl of light brown golden hair on the back of her neck, just below the big neck bone. She knew it was time. Under the sheet, she turned onto her back and wriggled an arm past my neck. Both our heads were together now, my chest and leg touching hers. I stroked her chest down the center to her navel, following the fuzz, and felt my chest grow sticky and huge. We were looking at each other's faces now, up close. Eyes, nose, lips. She had more fuzz all around her mouth and a mustache of little beads of sweat. She was touching my eyebrow, breath coming out in small, sweet, warm puffs on the corner of my mouth. I shifted down slightly so my eyes were level with her mouth and peered into the dark pink crack. I could feel my mustache growing too. There was a sound of movement from the other bed, and I quickly stuck my head out from under the sheet. Judy was on top of Sammy already. We hadn't even kissed yet. I pulled my head back in, rolling onto Rachel, and wriggled up slightly until my bunge was in the right place and the battery was held between our two bones. We kissed now, hurrying, just pushing our lips together and keeping them there for a second. When I lifted my head and licked around my lips, she did too. It was strange. Our sweat had mixed, wet and salty. Just going to read another bit about sort of the awareness of emerging sexuality in adolescence and how we sort of observe different things and female and male sides within ourselves. I watched Iggy's spriggy hair, hefty man self. He had an ease with it. Some other boys did too. Not like the hard black rasters silhouetted in the streetlight. They were slinky cats, moving into the night, their bodies liquid, rolling onto one foot and then the other, cool. They held their man self tighter inside them, coiled, ready to spring. I gauged how much of that cool I could really get right, practice the walk. But all that really came off was the stance, legs apart, bounce me no look. All the nights I studied their movements from the upstairs window, the way they pulled on the bright cigarette stub and then swung down the hand, grabbed the crutch, shift to the other leg, that stance was all I could honestly imitate. But I could do it any time I wanted to, even in a dress, and feel my man self standing like that. Didn't matter that I didn't have a Lolo muscle. Didn't have things that other girls have either, small feet and smooth hands. My bunge bone looked like it was about to grow muscle anyway. I could climb trees as high as any boy, had corns across my palms from swinging on branches. Judy had a man self too, could climb good. She could hang on for longer with her strong arms and pull herself back up. When we played Dung's War, one of her dungs hit you, it stung hard like one of the boys felt it. Rachel and Sammy, with their eye-blinking selves, always howled when she pelted them. Some of them big men's man-self was sloppy. It just hung around in the flab around the waist, jiggled in their shaking thighs and big bellies, came out in a belch or a too loud laugh or a slap on a woman's ass. Others held it stiff in their muscles, like Night Helicopter, the watchman at Enmore Estate. When he walked down the road to work, he strapped in some of his man-self with a big, broad leather belt over his khaki shirt. The thing was pulled in so tight, it looked like he wasn't going to breathe till he got there, 2 miles down the road. He'd roll from leg to leg, an aluminium saucepan of food in one hand and his baton in the other. And if you couldn't see his man-self then, puffed up like that, you couldn't see it in nobody. Jan and his friends dared each other to shout out his false name at him. Night Helicopter, to see him let out his breath, let go of his man self and run mad. Beef was like that too, charging his way through to the co-op to unload sacks of flour. Hell to trouble. He was short and square solid muscle. Always barged his way down the street, a belt around his waist too, even if he didn't have a shirt on. Belt on his bare belly and pants tied up below. Might knock you down if you didn't make way for him. Look back, had his man self so covered up, it was confusing. He'd walk and look back, small mincing steps and look again. Bird movements, his long neck swiveling, his hands jerking everywhere when he talked, eyes darting, pants belted right up on his chest. The Rastas had a different name for him. They called him Anti-Man, and he scuttled past them, fast into the street. I looked at my brother's man self. It was like he was just beginning to know he had it. And maybe I could see it better than he could. It was wobbling around in his voice sometimes and making his apple begin to bump out. His hands gripped too hard and surprised him. Growing feet kept stumping out toenails. His belly called for more and more food, and his man self came horsing out of his big teeth as he wolfed down a whole loaf of bread, laughing at how much he could eat. Dad's must have noticed it too, gave him the keys to bring the van into the yard, let him go to the cinema anytime he wanted by himself. We had to go with one of them. I was jealous that Jan didn't have to wear a shirt. My chest was just as flat as his, so I started walking around without one. I just wore a pair of Dad's old pants, held up with a string for braces. I began to hate Jan's man self, but wanted to stick around him all the time to do the man things with him. I enjoyed my man self with the boys. Bits of their man self soaked into me, and I learned then how to understand man self language, like with Ramesh, flitting from the great van job to his yard work. His man self was so soft and gentle and warm, it hurt me to see Dad shouting at him, or to see him looking at Jan, shame showing on his face for not knowing so much. I knew I could try out my she self on how my she self worked on with him, and he'd never embarrass me. I could trust him. My eye contact could bring a faint smile to his mouth. As I was learning the man self language, I understood Judy's hardness better. But in Sammy, I could see no man self at all. Out of the four of we, she was a delicate one. Legs skinnier than mine, turned up mouth and eyes that could blink good. She had a way that could make you give her anything she wanted. She knew, I recognized it. And later, when she got to growing her she self, she'd flash her long, straight she fingers in my face, nails growing already, just to irritate me. She didn't want to miss out anything, even when me and Judy played as rough as we could to try to stop her joining in. Saskia was only 2 years younger than her, but the two of them couldn't be left in the room for long. In no time, Saskia would be beating her up or thiefing her books or something. Saskia must have seen that get what I want shape of her mouth or look in her eye. Sometimes I felt sorry for Sammy, guilty about how we'd use her to get to go to the cinema and then treat her like she really too small to come. Never felt sorry for too long, though. At the dinner table, she'll be there giving everybody news, Miss Guyana Broadcasting Corporation. Who buried today, who went to the funeral, where the grave is in the cemetery, what the dead face looked like. Things we all saw together, she'd be letting out without even knowing it. Got us in trouble too. If that was what she self was all about, I go keep my man self till I old. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Unya. I'm going to introduce Thomas Glave now. Thomas Glave is Professor of English and Latin American and Caribbean Area Studies at the State University of New York, Binghamton. Among the honors he's been awarded are the O. Henry Prize for Fiction in 1997 and fellowships from the National Endowment for the Arts and the Fine Arts Center in Provincetown, as well as the Martin Luther King Jr. Visiting Professor in the Program in Writing and Humanistic Studies at MIT position in 2008-09. But my personal favorite is his contribution to the Jack Kerouac School of Disembodied Poetics with a workshop entitled, Who Exactly Are Those People? Thomas is also an activist. He has a long list of community service. He's a founder member of JFLAG, the Jamaica Forum for Lesbians, All Sexuals and Gays. He's lectured at the Elmira Correctional Facility, New York, volunteered with the AIDS Hospice in Kingston, Jamaica, and in HIV/AIDS Educational Outreach in New York. He is a member of the New York Foundation for the Arts, the Southern Poverty Law Center in Alabama, of Amnesty International, and he's on the board of directors for the Center for Lesbian and Gay Studies at the City University of New York. And I mention all these because obviously that's very much part of what this project, Breaking Sexual Silences, is about. Thomas Glave is therefore not just a writer, but then who is just a writer? If you're just a writer, then you don't have anything to say, do you? He's the author of the collection Whose Song and Other Stories, which was published in 2000, the non-fiction essay collection Words to Our Now, Imagination and Dissent, published in 2005, which won a Lambda Literary Award, and the edited anthology Our Caribbean, A Gathering of Contemporary Lesbian and Gay Writing from the Antilles, published in 2008, which also won the Lambda Award in 2009. And most recently, The Torturer's Wife, a collection of short stories published in 2008. Now, I want to just say a word about the Lambda Awards, since he's won two of them, and you might be wondering what they are. The Lambda Awards were founded in 1989, and every year since then, they've been awarded to the finest lesbian, gay, bisexual, and trans literature available in the United States. The LAMMY is the most prestigious, competitive, and comprehensive literary award offered specifically to LGBT authors. When he received it for Our Caribbean, Thomas Glave said, and I'm now quoting Thomas, "I felt and I still feel that that award wasn't just for me, but for Caribbean LGBT writing in general. And that book was a difficult, difficult book to complete, both in terms of logistics and also conceptualization. It was an exhausting project, literally, that required an enormous amount of energy and concentration, stamina, in fact, and took 5.5 years to complete. It wasn't really welcomed or thought much of by anyone I approached in the publishing world except the publisher that finally published it. The Lambda recognition for that book especially felt like a kind of triumph and a gesture of respect for the work of all those amazing writers in that collection." And it's that collection that Thomas is now going to present to us. Thank you, Thomas.
Thank you very much, Jane. I want to first of all say good night to everyone. Good night.
Good night.
Good night. And also, I want to thank Professor Allison Donnell, Professor Evelyn O'Callaghan. I want to thank Professor Jane Bryce. And I want to say, I mean, the generosity and hospitality that have been extended to us have just been remarkable. And I want to say what a joy and an absolute pleasure it is to hear Unya read. Once again, the last time I heard Unya read was actually in Jamaica at the Calabash Festival. And after hearing these selections of Buxton Spice again tonight, I didn't tell you this when you sat down, but I'm going to go back and read the book again. I've read it 3 times, I've taught it twice, and I'm going to go and dig it out from where it's not very far in my drawer under 2 other books that tied running, actually, and read it again in a couple of weeks when I get back to my own place. But this is also a place. It's a joy to be back at Cave Hill, and I just want to say thank you again. It's a pleasure. I am going to read, as Jane said, from Our Caribbean, and then I'll do a brief reading from The Torturer's Wife, from a story that is set in Jamaica. But just to say a little bit about Our Caribbean, aside from what you already heard, the book contains the work of 37 writers from 14 Caribbean countries, covering about 4 to 5 language groups, including some Creole groups. And so everything in the book appears in English translation, which I said was in some ways a disservice to the writers who don't write, think, dream, or speak in English, because their work appeared behind a kind of scrim of translation. And Betty Wilson, who's in the audience tonight, actually from Jamaica, and I have talked about translation before, and many of her comments about translation really, really hit home very hard when I was thinking about the sorts of logistics involved in dealing with this in this book. I'm going to read 2 selections from the collection, one by a Bahamian writer, Helen Clonaris, and then one by a Jamaican, Makeda Silvera. So the first by Helen Clonaris is called Independence Day Letter. And this piece was, it's brief, it was published in 2004 in the Nassau Daily Tribune as an open letter to the Bahamian population. And so you'll hear what she has to say here just now. She says, sorry, "Dear beloved community, It is the night of Independence Day. This country has turned 31 years old. I am only 4 years older. This is my home. This country where my grandparents came looking for new life, opportunities, a new way, hope. But I don't feel up to celebrating. Tomorrow, I have been told, at 5 o'clock p.m., there will be a protest in Rawson Square to show us gays and lesbians, bisexuals and tranny folk how much we are not wanted in our own country, to show us just how much we are not cared for, not valued by our brothers and sisters who believe they know what is good and righteous and godly. I live in a country that doesn't think I should exist. I live in a country where not one church leader has come to our defense publicly, where not one church leader has risen to the call of spirit to say loudly that this is a time for understanding, not hate. Instead, the church has, almost of one accord, it would seem, turned its collective back on the gay and lesbian community, condemning us all as sinners, or worse still, knowing that we are not sinners, keeping quiet anyhow because it is too afraid to show authentic compassion. Such compassion might be dangerous. It might expose a sympathy not permitted. Such compassion might create affiliations that could put jobs and reputations on the proverbial line. It is a Saturday night, Independence weekend, and there is not one church on this island that would welcome me and my kind publicly, speak our names openly, with respect, and honor us for who we are. I don't want to be accommodated. I want to be embraced. I need witnesses who are not afraid of what I am. If I'm going to be born again, I want to get born with greater love for and pride in who I already am. I need a minister who sees the sacred in me and won't turn his back on that sacredness because he doesn't know how to explain this kind of sacredness to his neighbors. I need a church, and there is not one. I'm angry at the church, angry at the Catholics, angry at the Anglicans, angry at the Baptists. I'm especially angry at the gay priests in this country who won't stand on the ground of their own truth and create a ministry for their own community, for the walking wounded who are told over and over that we are not right, that we are not good, that we are not welcome. But this is our home, too. I'm angry at these priests because they enjoy the privileges of priesthood, a priesthood built on secrets, half-truths, and lies, in which they remain too invested in that privilege to confront the churches and their own hypocrisies and injustices. I'm angry at suppressed truths at pedophiles. I'm angry at pedophiles fired from church-run schools but never brought to justice. I'm angry at violations suppressed. I am angry because I live in exile in this, my own country. I am angry because I hear the same tired and misconceived arguments over and over, and they're wearing me out, down. Missiles in the spirit are setting down in my front room every day, and every day I do the work of cleaning up the mess, the debris, shaken and outraged and grieved. Every day I pray for protection from the church. The church itself perpetrating a war on lesbians and gay men in this country, my home. Every day I hear apostles and pastors and bishops ranting and raving about how we are unnatural and deviant and dangerous. There is no love in their voices, no compassion in their words. Love the sinner, hate the sin. I talked with a pastor just the other day. He introduced himself to me after a press conference, and I spoke with him, wanting to be real. I told him that I respected his right to believe what he does. I told him that I would be one of the first to defend his right to speak freely and to act as his conscience bids him to. I told him that I hoped one day for us to stop this fighting across this imaginary line that divides us and begin telling the true, true stories that make us the people we are, acting and speaking out here in the world, because it's these stories that tell the truth about us and can speak to the heart of each of us. I told him that gay people aren't all about doing whatever pleases us and caring less about anyone else. That is a misrepresentation. I told him that gay people's lives are often full of pain. He looked at me with what seemed like sincerity and said simply, "I know." Throughout this exchange, the pastor seemed to be listening. He seemed to want to hear what I had to say, human being to human being. It felt good to be that real with this man whom I thought was my enemy. Perhaps I had misjudged him. We bade each other farewell, and then as I turned to go, I heard a laugh. It was a laugh that belonged to a woman, from a reverend, a friend of this pastor, who came to stand beside him. She laughed smugly, and I thought I heard the words, "Well, if they're in so much pain, they should come back to God." And then I heard the pastor's laugh, too. Now, if I were a more bigoty woman, I would have turned back and asked the reverend, the female reverend, why she was laughing. I would have asked the pastor, the male pastor, if he thought what I had revealed to him in earnest and in sincerity was funny. I would have told them how self-righteous and arrogant and wrong they were to presume that I had ever left God, or that God had ever left me to stand with them alone. But alas, I did not. I can only say that I left feeling that all too familiar outrage that comes with just being alive. In the distance, I hear the staccato of fireworks, independent celebrations underway, but I do not feel part of them. Tomorrow afternoon, in the middle of downtown Nassau, Bahamians, my sisters and brothers, will gather to make certain I am aware of how I am not welcome here, of how much I am not cared for, nor valued as I am, of how much better it would be if I did not exist. It is that personal, that real. The truth is, gay men and lesbians do exist. We're not deviant. We are not a sacred part. We are a sacred part of the natural diversity of this planet. We are part of the multicolored, multi-textured, multifaceted image of Goddess. We are your daughters, your sons, your brothers, your sisters, your grandchildren, your cousins, your mothers, your fathers, your aunts, and your uncles. We are your great-grandmothers. We are the children not born yet. We have important roles to play in the shaping of our society, the one we share with you. We are your family. Cut any one of us away from you and we both will bleed. We both will hurt. This is not the letter I had hoped to write in honor of this day. I had hoped to tell you how hopeful I am, how much I love us, this culture, this society of ours, which is strongly rooted, though we still are struggling to find our way forward through struggles together. I had hoped to tell you that I love how passionate we are about our everyday culture. Saturday morning souse and the beat of a goatskin drum that has the power to make you and your spirit get up, stand up, and go find out what it is you've been missing. I love the everyday spirituality that calls acquaintances cousin, neighbors beloved, and children baby doll and sweetness. I love that there is still a spiritual wisdom that endures outside the walls of prestigious churches, on the streets, the kind of wisdom that doesn't just believe but knows without need of political slogans that we all are family, regardless of skin color. Someone asked me some weeks ago, "What is it that you all really want?" I want to answer that for you now, sir, and anyone else who may be listening. I want to answer that now, again and again. What I want on this night of independence is this: a Bahamas that is committed to becoming honest enough and brave enough, and in the words of Chicana lesbian writer Cherie Moraga, quote, strong enough to embrace a full range of racial diversities, human sexualities, and expressions of gender, end quote. As well as a diversity of spiritual traditions and philosophical and ideological opinions. I want a Bahamas that is committed to restructuring its internal foundations so that it can better respond to issues of difference, not with the fear and anger that are now plaguing us, but with openness and genuine desire for understanding and communication and relationship. I still want a Bahamas in which women's lives are as important as the lives of men, and where children are seen and heard and listened to for their advice as to how we can be better parents and teachers and friends to them. I still want a Bahamas committed to decolonization, the taking down and the taking apart of old colonial ways of seeing, working, teaching, learning, being. I want a Bahamas wise enough and courageous enough to support progressive vision and to empower those with the emotional, spiritual, and intellectual creativity to put that vision into action. Cherie Moraga quoted once again, "Without the dream of a free world," wrote Moraga, "a free world would never be realized," end quote. I want a Bahamas where we aren't afraid to keep on dreaming, no matter how heretical our dreams may at first appear. Keeping the Faith, Helen Clonaris, Nassau, July 10th, 2004. Thank you, and thanks to Helen. I'm going to just read this brief selection from this essay by Makeda Silvera from Jamaica, published originally in 1992. It has since become a classic. Man Royals and Sodomites, Some Thoughts on the Invisibility of Afro-Caribbean Lesbians. Actually, interestingly, this essay is now taught quite a bit in women's studies and feminist studies in the Caribbean, Latin America, and other places. Makeda, I'm not starting from the beginning, so just to go on a little bit from here. She says, "The veranda. My grandmother sat on the veranda in the evenings after all the chores were done to read the newspaper. People, mostly women, gathered there to discuss life. Life covered every conceivable topic: economic, local, political, social, and sexual. The high price of salt fish, the scarcity of flour, the nice piece of yellow yam bought at Coronation Market, Mr. Lamb, the shopkeeper who was taking liberty with Miss Inez, the fights women had with their menfolk, work, suspicions of Miss Iris and Miss Punsey carrying on something between them, the cost of school books. My grandmother usually had lots of advice to pass on to the women on the veranda, all grounded in the Bible. Granny believed in Jesus, in good and evil, and in repentance. She was also a practical and sociable woman. Her faith didn't interfere with her perception of what it meant to be a poor black woman. Neither did it interfere with our Friday night visits to my Aunt Marie's bar. I remember sitting outside on the piazza with my grandmother, two grand aunts, and three or four of their women friends. I liked their flashy smiles, and I was fascinated by their independence, ease, and their laughter. I loved their names: Cherry Rose, Blossom, Jonesy, Poinsettia, Ivory, Pearl, Iris, Bloom, Dahlia, Babes. Whenever the conversation came around to some big woman talk, who was sleeping with whom or whose daughter just got fallen, I was sent off to get a glass of water for an adult or a bottle of cola champagne. Every Friday night, I drank as much as half a dozen bottles of cola champagne, but I still managed to hear snippets of words, tail ends of conversations about women together. In Jamaica, the words used to describe many of these women would be man royal and or sodomite. I heard sodomite whispered a lot during my primary school years, and tales of women secretly having sex, joining at the genitals, and being taken to the hospital to be cut apart were told in the schoolyard. Invariably, one of the women would die. Every 5 to 10 years, the same story would surface. At times, it would even be published in the newspaper. Such stories always generated much talking and speculation, from things like, "Boy, them can't get nasty, sir," to some wise old woman saying, "But this can't happen. After all, two shatan can't join," meaning identical objects cannot go into the other. The act of loving someone of the same sex was sinful, abnormal, something to hide. Even today, it isn't unusual or uncommon to be asked, "So how did two women do it? What uno use for a penis? Who is the man and who is the woman?" It's inconceivable that women can have intimate relationships that are whole, that are not lacking because of the absence of a man. It's assumed that women in such relationships must be imitating men. The word sodomite, of course, derives from the Old Testament. Its common use to describe lesbians or any strong, independent woman is peculiar to Jamaica, a culture historically and strongly grounded in the Bible. Although Christian values have dominated the world, their effect in slave colonies is particular. Our foreparents gained access to literacy through the Bible when they were indoctrinated by missionaries. It provided powerful and ancient stories of strength, endurance, and hope, which reflected their own fight against oppression. This book has been so powerful that it continues to bind our lives with its racism and misogyny. Thus, the importance the Bible plays in Afro-Caribbean culture must be recognized in order to understand the historical and political context for the invisibility of lesbians. The wrath of God, quote, "rained down burning sulfur on Sodom and Gomorrah," End quote, Genesis 19:24. How could a Caribbean woman claim the name Sodomite? And when, Bible in hand, my grandmother responded to my love by sitting me down at the age of 27 to quote Genesis, it was within the context of this tradition, this politic. When she pointed out that this was a white people thing, or a thing only people with mixed blood was involved in, to explain or include my love with a woman of mixed blood, it was a strong denial of many ordinary black working class women she knew. It was finally through my conversations with my grandmother, my mother, and my mother's friend 5 years later that I began to realize the scope of this denial, which was intended to dissuade and protect me. She knew too well that any woman who took a woman lover was attempting to walk on fire, entering a no man's land. I began to see how commonplace the act of loving women really was, particularly in working class communities, and I realized, too, just how heavily shame and silence weighed down this act. A conversation with a friend of my mother. Quote, well, when I was growing up, we didn't hear much about woman and woman. They weren't suspect. There was much talk about Batman business when I was a teenager in the 1950s. I remember one story about a man who was suspect, and that every night when he was coming home, a group of guys used to lay wait for him and stone him so viciously that he had to run for his life. Them time, he was safe only in the day. Now, with women, nobody really suspected. I grew up in the country, and I grew up seeing women holding hands, hugging up, sleeping together in one bed, and there was no question. Some of this was based purely on emotional friendship, but I also knew of cases where the women were dealing, but no one really suspected. Close people around knew, but not everyone. It wasn't a thing that you would go out and broadcast. It would be something just between the two people. Also, one important thing is that the women who were involved carried on with life just the same. No big political statements were made. These women still went to church, still got baptized, still went on pilgrimage, and I'm thinking about one particular woman named Aunt Vi, a very strong woman, strong-willed in everything. They used to call her Man Royal behind her back, but no one ever dared meddle with her. Things are different now in Jamaica. Now all you have to do is not respond to a man's call to you and then call you sodomite or lesbian. I guess it was different back then 40 years ago because it was harder for anybody to really conceive of two women sleeping together and being sexual. But I do remember when you were suspect, people would talk about you. You were definitely classed as different, not normal, a bit of a crazy. But women never really got stoned like the men. What I remember is that if you were a single woman alone, or two single women living together, and a few people suspected this, and when I say a few people, I mean like a few guys, sometimes other crimes were committed against the women, some very violent, some very subtle. Battery was common, especially in Kingston. A group of men would suspect a woman or have it out for her because she was a sodomite or because she acted man royal, and so the men would organize and gang rape whichever woman was suspect. Sometimes it was reported in the newspapers, other times it was not. But when you live in a little community, you don't need a newspaper to tell what's going on. You know by word of mouth, and those stories were frequent. Sometimes you also knew the men who did the battery. Other subtle forms of this was scorning the women, meaning that you didn't eat anything from them, especially a cooked meal. It was almost as if those accused of being man royal or sodomite could contaminate. And just briefly from a conversation with her grandmother, and I'll close this section. Am I okay for time?
No.
A little bit? Yeah?
5 minutes.
Okay. A conversation with my grandmother. I'm only telling you this so that you can understand that this is not a profession to be proud of and to get involved in. Everybody should be curious, and I know you were born with that ever since you're growing up as a child, and I can't fight against that because that is how everybody gets to know what's in the world. I'm only telling you this because when you're a teenager, you always say you want to experience everything and make up your mind on your own. You didn't like people telling you what was wrong and right. That always used to scare me. Experience is good, yes, but it has to be balanced. You have to know when you have too much experience in one area. I'm telling you this because I think you have enough experience in this to decide now to go back to the normal way. You have two children. Do you want them to grow up knowing this is the life you take? But this is for you to decide. I'm going to close very quickly with a selection from a story called Out There, which takes place in Jamaica, which is in my book of fiction, The Torturer's Wife. And this takes place entirely in Jamaica. And the moment at which I'm going to look is just focusing on two principal characters, two men, one named Aston, a middle-class brown man, middle to upper middle-class brown man, who's married and has children, and lives in Upper St. Andrew in Kingston, if you know that milieu. And poor or working-class fisherman, darker-skinned, whom he fetishizes and also desires, named Solomon James, whose pet name is Bratty, right? So I'm just going to read a little bit of this section and show some of Aston's desire for Bratty. Solomon, who soon after their first meeting had, in spite of the potential obstacles of his own high brownness, Aston's, versus Solomon's deep blackness, insisted that Aston call him so intimately Bratty. What the fisherman had made clear was how he preferred to be addressed. Not long after the two men had first encountered one another on the winding South Coast Road out in the dry parish, St. Thomas. That had been a blazing Saturday early afternoon when the staunch Adventists were at worship, and those in the area who fished and knew and competed with each other stood in that particular place by the side of the road with their day's catch in the hope of selling everything before the sun's vindictiveness ravaged their bounty. Driving by slowly as he had been, half dreaming about something peculiar Carol, his wife, had mentioned to him that morning, Aston had seen the fishermen standing by the side of the road, and then that one, who after only a few minutes of conversation had told the high brown city man, as if he were a true brethren, that Bratty, not Solomon, was his preferred name. One of those at first on the face of it unlikely but still charming Jamaican pet names originated sometime in childhood. Yes, sir, is my uncle did name me so. A true, Solomon had told Aston early on in his deep eastern Jamaica patois during one of their subsequent brief meetings by the side of the road. The city man always happening to drive past in his pajero and the countryman standing exactly there or in a tree-shaded spot nearby, holding up for driver's inspection a ring of snapper or sometimes a few brilliant azure-finned parrot, sometimes chatting quietly with his cronies. Solomon, to Aston's eyes and all those passings by, always so utterly beautiful, probably in his mid-40s, you could never precisely tell the ages of the very poor, as you could more accurately with others. A face full of wrinkles and a mouth of missing teeth, none of which astonishingly marred Bratty's sculpted beauty, could belong to a person still only in his mid-30s. The fisherman not at all self-conscious before the upper middle-class city man, Bratty, with a fisherman's rough hands made tough by harsh hours under the unforgiving sun out on the sea, from the very first completely unabashed about speaking full patois to the English-speaking city man. Aston had been struck by the fact that in speaking with him, Solomon never struggled in self-conscious English as his kind tended so often to do, ashamed as many of them had been taught to be of patois, yet stumbling through all the typical mispronunciations and embarrassing malapropisms glaringly present in their unguaranteed English. Miss Assimit for Mr. Smith, certificate for birth certificate, extinguished for distinguished. Yet, with his shrewdly attentive eyes, Solomon seemed to take in a great deal during the few brief conversations they had had, even, especially, conversing with a city brown man like him. My uncle, Solomon had told Aston early on, that was my mother, brother. Him did all the while tell my mother say that me would go to be one spile at picnic because she did never one day cane me, even when me run up and down the road with all the other boy them round the place, so. Him did always tell her, say, you're going to spoil that the boy there, him did say to her. So him did stay, always vex up. Him did always that kind of finky-finky. But trust me, me did no say him was a good man, a good Christian. So now one Sunday morning, when me did make myself ready, I go to church. Him did start to call me Bratty. Bratty, him did say to me, say, you was one little Bratty, Bratty boy. So him did say to me upon the road, so the name kind of sticky. Eh? And from that time, all the boy them in town did follow him up and start from then to call me Bratty. Is so them call me till now. But me true, true name my mother gimme is Solomon, for true. Solomon Aston had listened enraptured to the tale of naming, originated in vexation and a poor countryman's exasperation, endeavoring to imagine the high-spirited, mischievous young Bratty. He imagined the uncle's unpredictable wrath in a country that in those years had been powerfully convinced of the absolute correctness of very corporal punishment. Eh-eh, he imagined the wrathful uncle scolding, but what kind of hard-headed boy it is? My man don't bruck your forehead, Bratty boy. The reverie caused him to smile and did not demand that he acknowledge the rippling feelings of protection toward that younger Solomon Bratty. And so, of course, he had never told anyone, no one, that yes, believe it. He had always wanted, really and truly above all else, to curl his fingers around Solomon's surely Guinness-sized black balls and squeeze his hand around the surely plantain-thick uncircumcised black hood and rub it, rub, after which he would raise his hand to his face in order to sniff and lick, suck what he knew would be the strong roadside sweat crotch smell, pure hood. Then pull that hood that was not brown like his own, but black as the ace of Rossclot spades, he thought, stiffening more at the thought. How much stiffer could his own hood get before it tore a path through his zipper? Pull it, the fisherman's road sweaty, sea salty, rancid cock into his mouth. In it, in order to taste and suck sweat and strong hood smell, and ultimately Bratty's charging heat that would have jetted so powerfully power out of that engorged black manhood. He had imagined Solomon Bratty filling his throat and then, yes, of course, taking him from behind, Solomon's hood deep into what he too would have liked as daringly and rebelliously as others had done to have called his pussy, shouting out in his most unspeakable, dangerous imagination words like, Bratty, come breed me. Bratty, brethren, come fuck me now. Bratty, and grind your cocky hot, hot in my pussy. Solomon's black manhood filling up his pussy, he imagined, and roughing it in a way nothing his wife nor any woman could ever have done or would ever be able to do. He had never told anyone how many times he'd imagined all that, the more violent parts, and then the kisses that Bratty brethren would have bestowed upon him. Kisses bestowed mouth to mouth as the other man, that dutty black man, threw his fisherman's arms around him and held him and... Thank you.
Before we move on to the next part of the evening, would people just like to make themselves more comfortable? I'm aware that people are kind of uncomfortably hesitating or perched. Do you want to just take a few minutes?
There's not much room.
Oh, my God. Okay.
Well done. They weren't expecting that, were they?
Yes, amazing. You really...
Okay, just to say a big thank you again to the writers for extremely powerful readings. And I think one thing that came out of all of those readings was just how urgent and declamatory that voice needs to be at times. But also, on the other hand, you know, the ordinariness, the everydayness, the kind of inside and nowness of different lives. We're going to move on now to the kind of discussion part of the evening, and I'm very happy to be able to welcome two very prominent scholars who work in the area of Caribbean writing and in particularly sexuality, Professor Faith Smith from Brandeis University and Professor Pat Saunders from the University of Miami. And they're just going to say a few words in response to the readings, and then we'll open up the floor to discussion. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. I'm Faith Smith, and I just wanted to respond to the readings, and I may or may not turn them into questions that you may or may not want to answer before Pat speaks, and then we turn it over to the audience. So one thing to say would be that... Unia's reading from Buxton Spice, and now I have to add Thomas's last reading, for me are uncomfortable and shocking. And certainly when my students and I have read Buxton Spice, we're uncomfortable. I mean, I like to think they're uncomfortable too, but maybe it's just me. And it reminds me that these texts interrupt the silences of the nationalist novel. These texts interrupt the narrative of respectability. So on the one hand, it seems to me Unia Kempadu's text, Thomas Glaive's text, Beanie Man's texts, right, all disrupt this silence of respectability. Sex is not only respectable, sex is violent, sometimes violence is pleasurable, this is all messy, desire is messy. On the other hand, Beanie Man and middle class nationalists and the church speak with one voice on some things. So that the business of the novel and literature as the antidote to what Beanie Man is saying, I want to push back on that a little bit, and I don't know if you want to say anything about that. And then I was struck by Thomas reading from the Bohemian activist, this business about what do you want? And a part of the catalog of that list was Bohemian decolonization and freedom being linked to that. And of course, then that reminded me of Jackie Alexander's critique, always a kind of multi-pronged critique, both of the ways in which Caribbean people need to be more self-conscious about how we have been restrictive in terms of the range of possible desires, but always for her too, the critique of queer activism, queer international activism, queer metropolitan activism, which does not interrogate its own imperialism. So that was very interesting to me, that the catalog of what a Bohemian activist critiquing Bohemian homophobia wants is also decolonization for the Bahamas. Unia says, I didn't want to romanticize or sanitize. And so, again, the respectability narrative is being critiqued in different kinds of ways. And so writers as an antidote to that is something that we have to speak, because both there are different ways to break sexual silences, and this is being done in contradictory ways. Then finally, this business of the film and representation is very interesting to me, because it seems to me that film raises the stakes in all kinds of ways. There's a history of the representation of non-white people and the cinema. And on the one hand, the cinema is supposed to bear the burden of respectability and vindication for brown people. So we go to the film to solve a history of how we are treated in the world, but how the past has treated us on the celluloid. And so on the one hand, there's that. So in that sense, the film, we sometimes ask of film that it should cure all kinds of things, and therefore that ties us into a respectability narrative. On the other hand, the history of film is that Caribbean / paradise / sex are going to be brought together in particular kinds of ways. So in turning Tide Running into a film, I wondered if you wanted to talk about some of those stakes. So those would be some of my questions.
Thank you very much. Wow. Should we clear this? That's important.
Good evening. I guess I would want to, my name is Pat Saunders. I am director of the Caribbean Literary and Cultural Studies Program at the University of Miami. And I actually want to continue with some of what Faith said. I was particularly made, not even uncomfortable. I disagreed with Evelyn's opening claim that we would want to, you know, not talk to the musicians this evening, but to talk to the writers. Because I think there are a number of things I want to say. One is that we need to be cautious about romanticizing where and how within institutional disciplines or even within social structures interventions can be made. I think it was particularly striking that in Onya's reading, the centrality of play, which is one of the first arenas within which we begin to learn what it means to be man, what it means to be woman, what it means to be married, what the responsibilities, that whole scene of preparing dinner and cleaning the house, and the child in this sort of intimate space realizing that because their two friends had already started sexual performances, that it was their then expectation, right? So that there's an extent to which we have to think about that space, the schoolyard, as another place where we begin to understand ourselves as sexual beings, as performed by parents, by ministers, by teachers, etc. So I think that's one place. The other, I think that's also important, is that of material culture, of which literature is one part. We cannot lose sight of the fact Big Bubby Barbie, Ken Doll, Cindy, Mashup Midge, that these characters, as it were, become a kind of, if you will, safe space for children to begin to experiment with their sexuality before they themselves begin to try on the attire of sexual beings. So again, literature provides us one place of doing that, but I wouldn't want to institute it primarily as the space where it takes place. And I would also want us to think about the way, going back to Onya's reading, the interesting statement that film is where reality takes place. And for many children, that is where they begin to understand themselves as beings in the world, sexual beings, political beings, etc. And I would put alongside that music, right? Because in many ways, this is how they learn how sexuality is performed, linguistically, through dress, all of the things that Onya talks about in her reading. And I would want to return to dancehall culture as my own interest in my scholarly work and in the dancehall as a place that has a lot to teach us. It is remarkably ironic to me that in Thomas's reading that a gay brown Jamaican man who gives voice to his erotic dream about a black working class making love, or fucking a black, excuse my French for the children in the audience, a black working class man does so in the language of dancehall music. Read me. I mean, this is, and does so in a very misogynistic kind of way, right? That he, I mean, there's so much going on there that suggests to me that dancehall culture is always already there, and there's a way in which we, for ill or good, and I think it's also interesting that he's a middle-class man using the lyrics, if you will, or the language of the dancehall as a way of envisioning his sexual eroticism in relation to this black working-class man. So I feel like there, to center literature is to miss an opportunity to read all of these other homosocial spaces that young people, young adults, and adults begin to understand themselves as sexual beings. And I think that to suggest that literature is not in dialogue with the musicians, I mean, I think is to also forget that all of these dancehall lyrics we hear are written, whether we want to call it the Big L literature or whether you call it writing or not. I was once heard late, I think it was Tanya Stevens, talk about the fact that there was someone who wrote a song for her that essentially the lyrics were Minai no Liki Liki, this whole anti-oral sex rhetoric. And on stage, she's like, all right, yeah, I sing this song all the time. But personally, right? You know, my outside man, Musiam, right? That is a man that, and I mean, even in, so that we have to be mindful of the way in which performance is such an integral part of how we engage with the popular. And so I feel like that is the conversation that, as someone trained in literature, who is constantly looking and thinking about the way that literature is yet to catch up with the popular culture, that we would do well to sort of lessen that divide and to understand that there's an ongoing dialogue across these disciplinary boundaries and across, and even in between, as Faith said, there are ways in which Beanie Man, the church, and even some of the more Capleton and the other righteous, conscious vibes artists speak with one voice in one regard and then are diametrically opposed in others. And I think that those are occasions for us to really reflect on these unusual bedfellows, all pun intended, particularly where the state, the church, and the Rastaman meet, and in other ways where they diverge. So I think that I would want to stop there. Thank you. Thank you.
guys like to respond to the questions that we asked?
Yes, well, just basically the difference between film and how it's sanitized.
Yeah.